This is a message for those that work in manufacturing across the UK and Ireland.
Do your engineering maintenance doors keep you awake at night? Are your engineers spending excessive time sourcing and finding the spare parts they need?
Eric's on-site teams take responsibility for your indirect supply chain, including both your MRO procurement and inventory control. And, as the name suggests, we do this while being based on your site. For more information, visit www.erics.co.uk/EM.
This episode of Engineering Matters is supported by The Optimistic Outlook.
The Optimistic Outlook is a great listen for fans of Engineering Matters. It is a podcast for anyone intrigued by innovation across sectors, whether you're in healthcare, infrastructure, energy, or beyond. The show is hosted by Barbara Hampton, CEO of Siemens USA, and offers invaluable insights relevant and impactful for all industries.
I think what you're really going to like is that Barbara Hampton is not just a CEO, she's a thought leader in the corporate world. In the podcast, you often learn from her journey to the top of Siemens USA, getting invaluable lessons on leadership, decision-making, and navigating the complexities of the modern workplace.
Barbara brings a wealth of knowledge, not just about manufacturing, but about its ripple effects across all sectors. Her perspective illuminates how manufacturing innovations are setting the pace for changes in healthcare, infrastructure development, energy sustainability, and more.
Regardless of your industry, The Optimistic Outlook is a source of motivation and forward-thinking ideas. Barbara's expertise in connecting dots between manufacturing and other sectors reveals actionable strategies for innovation and leadership in any field.
We invite you to explore The Optimistic Outlook and join a broad audience that values transformative ideas, including us. Search for The Optimistic Outlook wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rhian Owen, and welcome to the HS2 Learning Legacy podcast. In this episode, we're talking to the people behind one of HS2's most popular learning legacy papers, and going to look at how HS2 went back to the drawing board when planning its design process. HS2 is Britain's biggest build, comprising 140 miles of track, four new state-of-the-art stations, two depots, and 32 miles of tunnel. As HS2's System Integration Director, Giles Thomas is responsible for bringing them all together.
It's a role that brings the company together, okay? It brings all of the different contracts together and encourages the organisation to use the contractual levers that it has, the technical requirements that it needs to achieve, and the delivery function and organisation to actually build a railway.
Giles's role gives him the chance to see each element of the railway coming together in real time. And it also means he can see how each step along the way adds to the learning on the project.
Because these programmes are long and take quite a considerable amount of time to design, to plan, to then construct and then make work, we engage different people at different points along the programme. So we've learnt a huge amount about the ground engineering from London to Birmingham already. And I think we've learnt lessons around construction and safety management. And of course, we've also innovated in a number of those areas. And again, those innovations need to be known about, broadcast, talked about. People need the opportunity to engage with the expertise that has come up with either these innovations or new ways of working or new knowledge.
While Giles' job is about making each component of this project come together to create an efficient high-speed rail line, HS2 as a whole has a chance to be a lot more. It will provide a step change in knowledge, skills and technology that will benefit the construction industry and other major projects for years to come. From the earliest days of the project, HS2 has been capturing learning from across the supply chain, and the earliest stage of most projects is the design. But not just one design. A single project can go through dozens of iterations, revisions, and alterations until there is a final design that the client, the architect, the engineer, and contractor are all satisfied with. But when you're building a piece of infrastructure as geographically widespread and engineeringly complex as HS2, this siloed approach to design would simply take too long. So HS2 redesigned the design process.
One of the things I keep wanting to kind of stress is HS2 is a hugely ambitious project in so many ways.
Kim Kwasi is a director at Arup and the lead architect for the Birmingham Interchange Station.
And in many ways, there are obvious things. There are project requirements and there are technical specifications and quite challenging requirements. But there is also this idea of creating a step change in, you know, the way we do things. And almost, I kind of often describe it as the Apollo project. Its real legacy isn't really just building a railway. Its real legacy is allowing us to investigate and think about other things.
When it came to bidding for the interchange design contract, Kim and his team at Arup quickly realised that HS2 wasn't just looking for an architect with nice designs. Jose Marquez Santoyo is an architecture lead at Arup.
I still remember the first day when Kim came to my desk and said, we do have a competition to run. I said, well, what is it about? It was a train station, relatively small train station in Birmingham. It wasn't that small at the end. And we did it at the beginning as a kind of a normal competition until we realized that it wasn't a normal design competition. It should kind of encompasses different disciplines at the same time because the ambitions of the client, as Kim said, were extremely high for the kind of the short time span that we had to run the competition. And on top of that, it wasn't just a kind of design competition in the sense of showing certain capabilities in design, some sketches, but to show how good our interdisciplinary team was meant to be in order to kind of work as a partnership, in a partnership with HS2, because this is effectively what HS2 was after, a real partner to develop the team.
Building a train station that met all the targets HS2 had set was not going to be easy.
You know, there's a very challenging 50% carbon reduction, embodied carbon reduction target. There was very much a kind of huge target around biodiversity and net gain. And this very interesting idea of, you know, the HS2 design vision of people, time and place, or people, place and time.
HS2 wanted its stations to be safe, both during construction and operation, all while incorporating passive design principles.
And that created a lot of contradictions in the different performance drivers that you need to articulate in a design.
Fernando Ruiz Barbarin is an associate at Arup's building envelope team. His focus is on the interaction between all the internal elements of the building that separate it from the outside environment. Fernando also led the coordination of the different disciplines working on interchange.
The way I think collaboration happens is there is a number of disciplines. There is perhaps a lead discipline in architecture that starts, you know, defining a geometry intent. And that model then is used by a number of disciplines to run their work, analysis, suggest optimization of certain aspects and validation of the design. And that happens usually by sharing files, and those files are then developed in different disciplines in isolation.
Fernando wanted a new way for design iterations to be shared with all the different disciplines working on interchange.
What we did in this project is we also started implementing a cloud-based platform that helped us share information differently, right? Rather than sharing files that are silo pieces of information, we share data straight from the designer's tools, right? So that sort of forces to develop a much greater awareness of our colleagues were doing, right? So we shift from isolated file sharing to seamless data sharing.
This cloud-based data sharing meant everyone was always working on the latest design, and teams didn't have to waste days or weeks waiting for a new design change.
And that meant that the steps between something, between somebody proposing something and it having an impact on another discipline, was like hours or days, you know, it wasn't weeks. And people were sitting next to each other. And so it was the closest that I think in the digital world you can get to that point where everyone's sharing the pen. The fact that Fernando and Jose and James, and, you know, the team, that kind of team was kind of just, you know, it was like alchemy. It was like really what it was like watching magic, because you weren't doing the normal thing where you were playing referee. It was just like, wow, this is amazing.
Fernando highlights two pivotal factors between using timber structures and implementing passive strategies in the design.
So there was two main things that were important, right? So timber structure and passive strategies, right? And those are great on their own, but they are contradictory, right? Because passive strategies means you cannot use mechanical equipment to control the internal conditions, and therefore the variation of the range of conditions is much wider. On the other hand, you have timber, which is a hydroscopic material which reacts to moisture content variation. So timber wants to have a very, well-defined internal conditions, whilst passive strategies are doing a bit of the opposite, kind of asking you to relax your expectations, right?
But the contradictions didn't stop there.
So an example of that is most effective area of natural ventilation was the ground floor where people are. And we were delivering that sort of modulation through the entrance door, right? So we have more doors than what was strictly needed for a sort of circulation purpose. So we were able to keep doors open in summertime to enhance a sort of natural ventilation and deliver that comfort. But we could then close them in winter, still leaving enough openings as required per sort of circulation occupancy requirements, but limiting the amount of sort of air circulation and sort of heat loss, right, in a way. However, that is also in contradiction with security and blast strategy, right? Because blast don't want to have hinge opening panels in the low level where the greatest threats are, right? Backpacks, suitcases, and so on. So there is another contradiction.
The design team worked with the HS2 security team to conduct a threat and vulnerability assessment. And construction planning specialists were brought into the design process early and embedded in the design team to ensure the design reduced construction time and risk. All this is brought together by the digital design software and collaboration tools that are now available.
I think there's something interesting about shared technology allowing people to talk to each other more iteratively and more kind of, you know, directly, plus the fact that they're sitting next to each other.
It forces you to reach some sort of principles that drive the design, you know, earlier on, that get you to a better place. And to, you know, like be able to fine-tune contradictory performance drivers in a much more efficient way, and so on, right? And that all takes you to a kind of a linear design, which is also key in delivering sustainable buildings.
The result is a station being built with sustainable materials while incorporating passive design features. One of the standout design elements is the station roof. The roof is made of a series of interlocking diamond-shaped leaves. This shape helps capture rainwater into a harvesting tank for reuse. And the design is completely modular. This means each roof segment can be constructed in a more controlled environment, reducing costs and risks by minimizing working at height. Then the process on site is more assembly than construction. All this resulted in the Interchange Station becoming the first train station globally to ever achieve BREEAM Outstanding status. The Building Research Establishment Environmental Assessment Method, or BREEAM, is a measure of sustainability for new and refurbished buildings. It evaluates a building's performance against a broad range of environmental criteria, from carbon emissions to resiliency to impact on local biodiversity. And receiving outstanding puts Interchange in the top 1% of most eco-friendly buildings in the UK. But Kim says achieving BREEAM outstanding isn't the most impressive part.
So in itself, there's not a single little thing. There were a number of things around kind of civil infrastructure and taking concrete out of the ground and working with the site topography and, you know, kind of philosophy of touching the ground lightly, which was one component of it. Then there was this part of being able to build this kind of, you know, deal with this sort of these kind of contradictions and try and resolve them. But actually, I think the really important thing around having a digital workflow was that it allowed us to drive cost out. So the story isn't that we've done BREEAM outstanding. The fact is that we've done BREEAM outstanding at no extra cost. And once you've done that, everyone else is saying, well, can we do it? So I think that's the legacy. You know, in a way, I think the important thing for us is legacy is really about saying, look, we all need to work like this, because this is a step change, and potentially if everyone's working in a sort of digitally collaborative environment, the benefits are huge. You know, they multiply their way across an entire industry and, you know, and then go into other things where we can drive to, you know, we can improve carbon outcomes, we can remove carbon both embodied and operational, and we can design to cost, and we can have better outcomes for people.
It wasn't just the stations that presented design challenges. Other assets up and down the line had their own unique problems that needed to be designed out. As a high-speed train races along the track, it pushes through the air in front of it. The air spirals off the front of the train, its energy dissipating. But what happens when a train travelling at more than 180 miles per hour enters a 16-kilometre-long tunnel? There is no space for the air to be displaced. Instead, it is pushed in front of the train. As the train heads on, the pressure in the tunnel builds. And at the exit to the tunnel, the air in front of the train expands rapidly outwards. A shockwave forms, causing a sonic boom. At least, that is what would happen without a tunnel portal. A tunnel portal extends out from the tunnel, controlling this movement of air. It helps solve a problem that engineers only became aware of when the first high-speed trains were launched. On the European mainland, other high-speed lines have used portals, but these have not been at the size needed for the Chiltern Tunnel on HS2.
One thing that does impact it is speed, so they were obviously built a certain length of time ago now, where train speeds weren't at the 320, 360 kilometres an hour that they are now. And we all, well, most people will know the sort of the design journey of the Japanese bullet train and how that has this great big nose at the front of it. Mm. Well, the reason why that was required was because after they built their tunnels, I think in the 60s, I think when they were constructed, they had this phenomenon of tunnel boom, and they went away and instead of having a civil engineering solution, they challenged their engineers from what can we do to the shape of the train to mitigate this build-up of nose pressure.
This is William George, a senior engineer with Jacobs, who worked on the design of the Chiltern Tunnel, along with his colleagues
Darren Carter
and
Lee Canning,
who are both senior associate directors at Jacobs. The three of them have written a paper together for the Learning Legacy project, looking at the design of the Chiltern Tunnel's South Portal. A paper like this illustrates the value of a Learning Legacy programme.
It's the first porous portal ever built and constructed in the UK. The examples that exist on the continent are a lot smaller, as in maybe 20 metres long. I don't know if it's the longest portal in the world, but like I say, the examples that I'm aware of on the continent are considerably shorter.
Partly why we were eager to write this paper was because, as far, you know, when we right at the beginning, we looked around and there wasn't much information available for, you know, for the engineers and the profession. So we thought it's definitely worthwhile to share what we've learned.
The length of tunnels like that through the Chilterns prompted the need for an innovative portal design. For this portal, a porous design was needed, with vents along the top and sides. While this was a novel project, Jacobs didn't start with a blank slate. Instead, they worked from specifications developed by HS2. These included expert advice from a computational fluid dynamics, or CFD, consultancy.
HS2 have contracted a consultant to undertake some what they call computational fluid dynamics to understand exactly how the air moves within the system, both from the beginning of the portal, through the tunnel, through the shafts, and out the other end of the portal. Once you've determined exactly what the structural form will be, how the various parameters work together, you then feed that back into the CFD model, and you get a kind of thumbs up or a thumbs down from HS2's consultant.
The design would need to meet the requirements set out in these documents. At the same time, it was necessary to consider how the portal would be built alongside the tunnel being bored.
We knew there were certain parameters we need to consider within the various options, and we knew there were various shapes and vent locations that we needed to consider. And we were very much in this kind of scheme design kind of phase. So we would go through a process where we would present to what they called an IPT, which is an integrated project team. So it was us, Align, and HS2 all in the same building. And we agreed a set of classifications, groupings that they would score the various options against.
The integrated project team settled on an overall design for the tunnel. The next step in delivering the portal was to consider how it would interact with the giant tunnel boring machines, or TBMs, that were being used to dig the 20-kilometre tunnel.
One of the biggest driving factors of the Chiltern portal was launch of TBM and everything that went in to launch those TBMs.
The portal would be mounted on a concrete slab. Assets on HS2 are designed for a 120-year lifespan. Every time a train passes through the portal, pressure will put strain on the concrete and steel structure. So this slab needed to be strong, but it also needed to allow other work to continue on site.
The TBM and all the construction plant that goes with that pretty much defined what that large wall slab had to be.
Before work on the portal could begin, the team had to consider how the TBM would be launched.
To facilitate the launch of the TBM, the slab was built, the head wall was built, so the tympanum, it was, you know, dubbed the tympanum, was built. And then there were also elements called shifting ways, which were basically geometrical shapes to support parts of the TBM machine, so the backup gantries of the TBM machine.
In traditional architecture, a tympanum is a semicircular decorated wall, often seen above cathedral doorways. On a tunnel project, it is the arch around the flat surface, or head wall, that the TBM first engages with as it breaks into the ground. The Jacobs team would have to consider how the tympanum would fit within the starting point for the portal. The shifting ways and other elements needed to launch the TBM would need to be incorporated into their design, and they would need to find a way to connect the portal walls to the slab without masses of rebar preventing site movements.
So you can imagine sort of we've got this expanse of flat base slab concrete that needs to have reinforcement coming out of it so we can start all the permanent works. So how do we go about detailing that so that we haven't got people sort of tripping over or falling over and seriously hurting themselves? That there was a lot of detailing around that reinforcement.
We extensively used couplers, didn't we, in the slab? So to prevent any starter bars, any rebar protruding out of the slab, to build the walls, which was obviously for the permanent scenario, and to facilitate crane movements going anywhere where they wanted to go on the slab. We used couplers, so coupler bars, which are sort of sockets, and your rebar that you're then going to attach to, it's threaded.
The expert advice of the computational fluid dynamics consultants, HS2's overall design criteria, and the practicalities of building one of Europe's longest high-speed rail tunnels all had to be considered. Working with the integrated project team, Jacobs refined its design.
The top half is a semicircle, and that curve matches the tunnel in size and shape. And then the bottom half are vertical walls. So to achieve that increase in area, the wall height essentially just increases linearly from tunnel interface to open end of the portal. And there was a bit of a presumption from our team that, oh, well, a buried option is going to be the preferred because you can't see a buried option, of course. But then after various workshops and architectural input and actually understanding from viewpoints, what's the general public actually going to be able to see?
The finished design met the aerodynamic requirements of the portal. It would flare upwards at a consistent angle until the portal opening was 1.5 times the area of the tunnel exit. It would also not stand out against the landscape, but would present an elegant structure when visible.
Yeah, it's a balance of the engineering and the aesthetics and the aerodynamics. But there was, you know, a feeling at the time, it's very early on in the design process, but an arch structure is more efficient, so there would be some form of cost benefit. Perhaps maybe slightly more difficult to construct. Although we managed to, you know, with the flared option we came up with the vertical flare, helped make the construction as efficient as possible by having the same semicircular shape all the way down.
These factors all contributed to how the portal would be built. The design challenges didn't stop at this point. Later in the project, it was determined that a crossover slab would need to be built close to the portal slab. The crossover slab supports tracks where they cross. Each slab must be designed for the project's 120-year lifespan, so it was vital to consider their interaction. Throughout the project, the team saw the value of an integrated approach.
I mean, the one thing that I learned along the way was, it may seem obvious, but, you know, being open with your partner, particularly between the constructor and the designer, you need a lot of openness, and sometimes that needs a bit of bravery, moving outside of your comfort zone.
One of the main things I think has made this contract a success is the introduction of what they called an IPT, which was an integrated project team. And that was every decision that was made. You had people from the design team, you had people from the contracting team who were aligned, we were aligned, and you had representatives from HS2 who were in positions of authority to make decisions. And having those three parties at the table for every significant meeting just moved the design along and kind of reduced friction. And you had to be brave and you had to be honest and speak your mind. But I think it progressed. It progressed at a rate that was quicker than my experience on more conventional contracts.
These and other topics are considered in detail in the paper that William, Lee and Darren wrote with their colleague Robert Brown for the Learning Legacy Archives. The paper will give other designers a head start when new tunnel portals are built, but it will also support the design and construction of other assets using similar techniques.
We needed it at the start, didn't we? We looked for the information and it wasn't there. And it's applicable to almost every structure type, I suppose, isn't it? No one would usually design a 200 metre long structure without any joints in for movement, but from a durability perspective and a maintenance point of view, we took these stances and made these decisions that, and then that you know, it produced design issues that we had to solve, basically, and they're not going to be limited to tunnel portals. They're applicable to many other, I'm sure, of structures that would need to be developed by others.
I would agree with the idea of a learning legacy. You know, over the decades that I've been an engineer, we have grappled with lessons learned, project sheets, corporate amnesia, just grappled with it. And the number of times we've gone in and we know we've done it before, but we can't find the evidence or any kind of indication of how we need to do it again.
Projects like the Chiltern Tunnel Southern Portal and Interchange Station are proof that a more collaborative and integrated approach to design and construction, along with new technology and software, can result in infrastructure projects meeting numerous, sometimes seemingly contradictory, goals. And now the wider industry has the opportunity to learn, implement and even improve this approach to raise the bar for the UK's design and construction industry, making it more efficient than ever.
It is really important to tell the world the extraordinary things that are happening, not only in our project, but throughout the line, and the thousands and thousands of people who are working on the project. And they're all have been given the opportunity to innovate and drive things forward. Thank you.
I've been your host, Rhian Owen. Thanks to our guests, Kim Kwasi, Giles Thomas, Jose Marquez Santoyo, Fernanda Ruiz Barbarin, William George, Darren Carter, and Lee Cannon. You can get more detail on all the topics featured in this series by taking a look at the HS2 Learning Legacy website. We have provided links in the episode description. To learn more about HS2, go to hs2.org.uk or follow us on social media at HS2LTD.